You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
You think they're foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Go pink for freedom, go pink for peace, go pink to hunger. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger and war have ceased. Code pink for women, boys, men, and girls. Together
Well, good morning and welcome to Code Pink Radio. You're listening to Code Pink Radio on WPFW in Washington, D.C., 89.3, and WPAI in New York, 99.5. You may be streaming at www.wpfwfm.org. This is all part of Pacifica. I am one of your hosts today, Pocky Wieland, and I'm in the studio with
Terry Mattson. So pleased to be here with you this morning.
And we have our wonderful young intern,
Ayani from Howard.
And so here we're ready to
So we have a multi-generational show this morning. I love it.
We do. And I'm so happy that we'll have our reflections on what's happening in this world and an analysis, and we'll get it from all these three perspectives. So that's great. We have a few announcements about upcoming events, so let's get started with these before our wonderful guest, Mark Weisbrock, joins us. Today at the OAS, you may have noted, if you watched or heard anything about the State of the Union delivery, there was a man who was noted by the President of the United States as the, did he say he was the President of Venezuela?
He's the stand-up, self-appointed President of Venezuela, and backed by the United States.
And he is in D.C. right now. So there are people who will be noting that and protesting that at the OAS at 3:30 p.m. That 17th and Constitution on Tuesday, also in line with this Venezuelan awareness we have, there's a trial is starting here in D.C. for the four embassy defenders. They're going on trial because, as many of you know, there was an attempted coup in Venezuela, orchestrated, I think, in large part by their northern neighbor, the USA. Is that?
Yeah, something like that. That threat from the north that 200 plus years ago, Simón Bolívar even recognized as a threat to Latin America.
And some threats just don't go away. But we are doing our part to diminish that threat and to support solidarity with the Bolivarian Revolution, which also continues quite remarkably.
The resiliency of the Venezuelan people is quite something to witness on the ground in Venezuela. If you ever have the opportunity to go, I returned from Venezuela late January, and for my 17th visit there over the last 12, 15 years, and it really is quite something to witness, and it is a completely antithetical experience than what we read here and talk about here in the United States.
Yeah. So we'll keep people posted as to opportunities you have to join Terry, I hope, to visit Venezuela.
Well, we've got a couple things while we're talking about announcements. Let's talk about some of Code Pink's travel opportunities coming up this year. We have a pre-election day observation delegation to Bolivia, March 21 to 29. We're looking for some people with Spanish language skills, previous election observation experience, and Latin American solidarity work. That's March 21 through 29, trip to Cuba, April 25 to May 2nd. It will be a multi-city trip finishing in Havana for May Day, back to Bolivia for Election Day, May 3rd. That trip is May 1 through 6. And then we are co-sponsoring. Code Pink is co-sponsoring in partnership with the Alliance for Global Justice and the Honduran Solidarity Network, of which we are a member, an emergency human rights delegation to Honduras, May 7 through 17. And in the works right now is a human rights delegation for late summer, early fall to Colombia. You can contact me at terri@codepink.org and or go to codepink.org to see more about these trips.
Thanks.
They're great educational opportunities.
They are. You know, we can have lots of solidarity and intellectualize and get very emotional about as we hear people from these various countries come and talk with us. But if you have the opportunity to actually visit with Code Pink in these delegations, I highly encourage people to do that. So but if you're back here in this country and you're it's not quite May, the end of April, we'd like you to join us for a game night, Beautiful Trouble. Nadine Block, who is the author of the book Beautiful Trouble, has a card game that it is both fun and incredibly educational. And this will be on Sunday evening, February 16th. How to get through February. This is one of the good ways to do it at the Busboys and Poets in Tacoma Park, February 16th at 5 p.m. So that's another activity. And finally, in February, we have a series of actions in support of Julian Assange. Julian Assange, as everyone probably listening knows, is still incarcerated in Great Britain. And so we are joining with people who want to educate people about the situation that Julian Assange is living under and give people opportunities to respond. So those are my announcements, and thanks for expanding on the Venezuelan. Anything else, Terry?
Well, you know, I'd like us to take a moment and just mention the fact that Kirk Douglas died last night. And you know, for you and I, Pocky, not so much you, Yanni, or impossible for you, Yanni, for him to really represent a lifetime of film for us. And, you know, one of my favorite films of his, and probably the most significant as far as a real Hollywood statement of activism, was his production of Spartacus, in which that helped end the Hollywood blacklist, and it was a very significant moment in Hollywood activism and a really brave stance financially, politically, and career-wise for him to do that. And I just a big loss for me personally. It was a magnificent film career to watch over my lifetime. Although I'm not 103, which I'm proud to say it is what he died at. Imagine living to be 103. What a wonderful gift.
Yeah. Yes, and I think it is a reminder that we do have a rich history of resistance, and part of that was resistance to the blacklist, resistance to Joseph McCarthy, and certainly his ghost comes back in what's happening right now in D.C. with the president and the impeachment.
These people are good historical examples. yeah. for us to learn from.
Yeah. So thank you.
So we have a really wonderful guest joining us this morning to share
with us. We're going to wait for him to join us, but right now we can do some talking ourselves, some of our own reflections on what's been happening. And I'm curious, Yanni, you're a student, a third year student at Howard University, and I'm curious, what's the buzz at Howard about the impeachment? Anything?
So, as some people hopefully may know, Howard is a very opinionated campus, and there's so many people from so all over, so everyone has a lot of different perspectives. Not all perspectives you hear. Most of the perspectives is not, a lot of people that I've interacted with, not everybody is for Trump, and so everyone is kind of just feeling as if the way the trial is going, things aren't being pulled to the surface as they should. They're more so being buried under the rug and kind of like, it's like a stick over a wound, more so, kind of just trying to say, well, we want to keep him in office, so we're going to do what it takes to just cover up all the damage that they feel he has done and proceed and maintain him as president. So there hasn't been, from what I've seen thus far, from the perspectives I've seen, there hasn't been much satisfaction with how the trial is going. And a lot of people are hoping that his impeachment does fall through, but the way things are looking in terms of the trial, it doesn't look like their hopes are going to be answered. Yeah. So it's just kind of like a lot of disappointment, a lot of dread. Coming from HBCU, it's kind of like a slap in the face, especially because of the way and the mores that he seems to have stand on and proclaim throughout media. It just, it's kind of a hard time for a lot of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's echoed throughout the country. So, it's an interesting thing. I heard that the Democrats are coming together to push forward other articles of impeachment, and it'll be interesting to see where that comes out. But we do have this precedent of in the past, and there have only been three prior impeachments, actually two that were followed through because Nixon resigned before his impeachment went all the way through. But they've always had people from their own parties, and Mitt Romney startlingly deviated from that. But we have our guest on now, and so we'll turn to him and continue this conversation.
Good morning, Mark.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, how are you doing?
We're so pleased to have you join us this morning. So let me introduce you to... thank you for accepting the invitation, and let me introduce you to our audience. We have listeners in Washington, D.C. and New York City, and then we... stream across the nation as well. So you'll have a wide audience to share with this morning. But for our listeners, our guest this morning is Mark Weisbrot. He's an economist and columnist. He is co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, CEPR.net. And he is also the president of Just Foreign Policy, foreignpolicy.org, and Foreign Policy is a non-governmental organization dedicated to reforming U.S. foreign policy, which we sure need a good conversation on that this morning after Monday's debacle and the impeachment and the visit from the stand-up president of Venezuela. We've got a lot to talk about this morning. So, Mark, it's really a pleasure to have you here for the audience. Mark has been very active in Latin America and U.S. economic policy, and has many years of experience and fantastic expertise to share with all of us. And so Paki and I would love to have a conversation with you this morning regarding some of the more significant issues and policies related to the presidential primaries and some of the candidates specifically. And maybe regarding the primaries, we should start with this the Iowa caucuses and the delay in the ballot count, which we've seen elsewhere in the Americas as well in the last couple of years.
Well, there have been comparisons to Bolivia because, you know, there was a delay actually in Bolivia. I'm sure you know the story and you've talked about it. But, you know, in the election in Bolivia on October 20th, there was a delay in reporting the results. And it wasn't even the real results. It wasn't even the official results. It was just what's called a quick count, which is done kind of informally to keep people posted on what the, you know, what's going on, while the official count, which takes much longer, all the ballots are being counted. And so there was a delay. And then the Organization of American States, backed by the Trump administration and the Bolivian far right, all used that delay in the reporting to say that the election was stolen. And so that was the basis for the coup of November 10th that overthrew a government which even nobody disputes was democratically elected in 2014. And that's, you know, obviously there are comparisons that can be made, because I think I was even worse. I mean, worse than, you know, I mean, it's a lot worse, because there wasn't actually any fraud, as it turns out. That was all a huge lie. And that, you know, we've put evidence on that. Anybody can see that if they want it, cepr.net. We've looked at all the so-called evidence of so-called fraud, and it was all fake. And, I mean, really fake. You know, the media hasn't really reported this yet, but it really is very simple. It was just eighth grade arithmetic, you know, and I can go into that if you want. But in the Iowa case, I mean, you know, I can't even follow what happened there yet. We have to have an investigation to really say what happened.
Well, maybe we should have a UN election observation delegation own. Maybe that's the next Code Pink delegation we should organize. We'll go to Bolivia and then come here.
Just don't invite the OAS.
Right, exactly.
They really can't be trusted.
Yeah. You know, I remember years ago remarking on how Jimmy Carter would go off and be one of the leaders in the observation of elections in other parts of the world, and asking, well, God, if they can do that in Nicaragua, why can't they do it here? And one of the responses I got was, because we don't have a universal plebiscite that that each state does its own elections. And and I don't know if you've thought about that or written or talked about that, Mark, but if you have any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them.
Well, I haven't written about that, but obviously it's been an increasing call here for international observers since our 2000 election, which we don't really still know to this day, you know, who won.
Right.
And so, yeah, the U.S. system is very weak in so many ways. And, you know, but I think the bigger issues are really the lack of democracy, the disenfranchisement that we have, the low voter turnout compared to Europe or even Latin America as a result of all the difficulties in voting. You know, every country I know or I'm familiar with, it has elections on a Sunday, you know, for starters. And, and then, of course, you have Trump losing the election by nearly 3 million votes and still becoming the president,
right.
And the Democrats winning the Senate by 12 million votes and still losing the majority. And you have so many obstacles to democracy here. It's really just a very partial form of democracy. And I think the country would look vastly different if you had even just voter participation rates that compared with most of the high-income countries in the world. I don't think you'd have people like Trump wouldn't have, and the Republican Party would have very difficult
The largest percentage of eligible voters affecting election results in the United States is that percentage of people who don't participate.
Yes, and it's, you know, it varies very hugely. I mean, especially you know, for example, the white working class vote, which is the one that swings most presidential elections can go from, 70% Republican to about close to 50-50. And that's, again, you have these impacts because of the system, the way it's set up.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And of course, there's so much voter suppression. So we say, well, are there, it's almost a moot point. Is, what are the factors? Why aren't more people voting? And I think you're noting that we have the lowest turnout perhaps in the world. And part of that is suppression, and part of that is disinterest, alienation. And I wonder, how do we counter that? And one of my jokes is if God wanted us to vote, she would have given us good candidates. But I think there's some more substance to the reason people aren't voting. And a lot is being done in various states to correct, especially the voter suppression. So we get people out to vote, and for whom? And I think that's a question that keeps arising.
Well, look at the mobilization of young people around Bernie Sanders.
Uh-huh.
Despite the U.S. media narrative against him or rising, raising the visibility of candidates other than him. So then that mobilization has continued. And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Bernie's one thing that has been different about him. He does frame the whole campaign as building a movement, and he argues that that's the only way that you can win. And, of course, part of his argument is the one we just went through of the lack of democracy here, and he looks more at, he looks at the things that we discussed, but also he focuses on the power of these donors and the huge corporations and the 1%, as he says. And so he basically started with this premise that the only way you can win is to build a mass movement that can actually get out voters. And I think he has put forward a program that really would change people's lives, in so many ways, from the Medicare for all to the minimum wage hikes. And a lot of it has become, of course, has been adopted by other candidates, but even his enemies in the media acknowledged that he was the one who put these issues, free college tuition at public universities, student debt. He was the one who brought most of these issues that really will motivate people in this race. There'll be other motivations. Obviously, there's Trump on the other side, but he was the one who made these the main issues of the Democratic candidate.
Yeah, and what it seems he's done too is that he's really made the things that we used to call the bread and butter issues are the bread and butter issues of people today. The health care and student debt are two of the major bread and butter issues that people are dealing with, and to address that head on, I think is certainly a departure from the old Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think that it is. It is definitely a much more progressive program, and again, that he has spread to others. And I think also he has, you mentioned the young people are, that's his biggest base. He has a majority of people, I think, under 30. And he has, if young people turned out, if they voted anywhere near the rate of, say, people over 65 or over 60 or even over 50, he would win overwhelmingly in this primary. I think he still might win. But that's, again, the participation. And there you can see, participation, why do young people have a lower participation rate? Well, part of it is, they move and they, their address changes and they're not registered, and they have, so there are, again, in the primary as well, there's even more restrictions in some states. that make it more difficult for them to vote.
Yeah. Let me check in for a moment with that. On that, we have a local expert. We have a young person sitting here in the studio with us.
From Howard University, and maybe she can comment on student participation and what...
What your observations, yeah.
This is a good point you brought up, Mark, and we have a young woman here with us at the moment.
So I definitely do agree that younger participation is definitely prevalent, especially to the election, because we see what I've noticed with the Obama election, Obama and Trump, when that took place, Obama and Trump, when that took place, I couldn't even vote at the time, right? So...
And you couldn't vote because of age?
I was in high school. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Obama and during my high school time, it was Obama and was it Trump?
No.
It wasn't Trump. It was...
It was Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney. I'm sorry. I forgot. Sorry. So
who's come back into focus.
But, so growing up, especially so in New York, I had told on Code Pink when I started interning, I wasn't raised on the importance of politics. It wasn't strained in school. And I wasn't aware of how serious it was until Obama and Mitt Romney. And during that time, I feel like that's how everybody started voting, because it was, somebody of our skin tone, somebody of our color. That's when everybody kind of went bonkers. So everyone who was able to vote then ended up going out and voting. And the mass population that won over the vote for Obama were people of that generation at the time that I am now part of, that age group, right? So then when it came to Trump and Hillary, it was that whole entire population, I still couldn't vote at the time, that whole entire population, because of age, was it felt like a lose-lose situation. So that whole entire population left and didn't vote.
It felt like a lose-lose situation for a lot of us.
Right.
All demographics.
So that whole entire population decided to say hands off. And that's how everyone who was so confused about Trump winning the election was how did he win? How did he win? And so when you talk about the importance of youth, you have to understand that they are literally what brought Obama. And then they are the reason why Trump was allowed to push him, because everyone was Hillary, yeah, she says she's a Democrat, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, she's still not her campaign wasn't adding up with what she was trying to profess for us and with our needs. So now being on Howard's campus and with the upcoming election and so forth, I see that it's a needed issue. And when you talk about Bernie Sanders, I was just thinking in my head, the minute you say get rid of student loans, everyone's gonna love Bernie. You know what I'm saying? Everyone's gonna be Bernie, let's do this. You know what I'm saying? So you gotta it's a really good strategy, I guess, to aid towards, just catering to our needs and kind of pulling us in, because we literally are, as the Bible says, the youth will lead the people, the children will lead the people. We are the ones who kind of make things shift. If your friends is on board, you're on board, and everything kind of just moves and word kind of just spreads really fast. And that's how you get a movement.
You know, I have to say, I've talked to a lot of people your age, and I'm pleased they're willing to talk to me. I'm old enough to be your mother. Mm-hmm. And people, the first thing I'll hear 18 to 25 year olds say, we know everyone says Bernie's old, but we don't care about the actual identity politics. We care about the policies, and he's the only one speaking for us.
Yeah.
And don't we wish everyone's grandparents spoke for the young people today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely do agree with that. I definitely feel like he speaks to the masses, especially to those even of definitely catering to the oppressed, especially speaking to women, speaking to African-Americans and so forth like that. Speaking to African-Americans and speaking to women, groups of mainly oppressed. So when you speak to those groups and youth kind of see that, especially in this day and age where youth are kind of being more valued in their ability to verbalize how they feel, and it's being taken into consideration in terms of everything, then that's how you really create movement and move forward.
Yeah. So just need to say one thing, speaking of women and all of Bernie's support for women, I'd like to just note that Elizabeth Warren was the first person who brought up the issue of student debt forgiveness, but that does not take away a thing from Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just interrupt you to remind you that it's 11:30 and it's time to tell you that you are listening to Code Pink Radio on WPFW, and you're listening to us live also on WBAI. You may be streaming too at WPFWFM.org. We're happy to be here with Code Pink and with our wonderful guest, Mark Weisbrot.
Thank you, Mark. And Mark will join us for some further discussion after our mid-program break.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not a
So welcome back to Code Pink Radio and to our guest, Mark.
Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic Policy and Research and Just Foreign Policy. And Mark, thanks for joining us for this second segment of our show. And let's spend the next few minutes talking about the major issues, or I would say, you know, maybe as you would frame it, what are some of the major issues for this campaign season, and what should we as voters be focused on, particularly those of us who are anti-military expansionism, anti-U.S. adventurism, and how maybe some of that war machine money can come home and help all of us, including our students?
Yes. Well, it was a good choice of song, not only for climate, the end of the world as we know it, but also the line that I've always liked is, offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. That should come from a lot of the editorial boards that we have in this country, because there are alternatives and there are solutions, and they're in this race right now. And, well, I mean, you can pick the issue. Obviously, I think that in terms of foreign policy, you do have Bernie standing out in terms of what I would call harm reduction. And I think that's, a major, a major goal of the anti-war and peace movements here is just reduce the harm that our government is causing in the world. And I think where Bernie played a very important leadership role is in the Senate, to get that vote passed under using the War Powers Resolution, which was passed in 1973 and hasn't really been used in 45 years, barely, and to say that U.S. military has to stop participating in the genocidal Saudi war in Yemen, which has killed over 300,000 people and caused the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And so that's the kind of thing that's really, really important. And again, these people, you see this all in the media all the time, what's Bernie going to get done? How can he work with other people? Well, he worked with very conservative Republican senators like Mike Lee to get that passed. And, a lot of people don't know this, but, they had the votes even before Khashoggi was murdered, and then they got even more, but they had a majority, and that was a lot of Bernie's work and Bernie's leadership. And then, of course, the House passed it as well. Now, Trump still didn't get out, but I think almost any normal president would have by now, even possibly George W. Bush. It's just Trump has a particular relationship with the Saudi kingdom and also with Israel that has kept him there. But this is the kind of thing that he has, you know, demonstrated. It's not something that gets him any points or, you know, gets him elected. He did it because he really cares. I think that's what I think why you see all these young people for Bernie, because it's this kind of authenticity that they see. And the foreign policy is where it really stands out the most, I think.
You know, this is something that I always bring up in just my activist conversations among friends, is that, you know, it's wonderful to have a great domestic plan for all of us U.S. citizens, but I think the thing that Bernie and a few others understand is that it is not me, and I am clear about this when I speak with activists, it's almost impossible for us, the way our war economy is structured today in the United States, to have a successful domestic policy without reforming U.S. foreign policy and our practice of warfare and adventurism.
I think that's true, and I think it works not only in terms of the economics of it. Obviously, we've got this military budget that has, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of waste, and we could use that for, you know, other things. And of course, if you have a real arms race, which a lot of people are moving in that direction, you know, you have this shift now officially from the so-called national security state, from anti-terrorism or fighting the war on terror, to this great power competition. If you have an arms race with China, you know, China's economy is already 30% bigger than ours on the measure that most economists, all economists use for international comparison, which is purchasing power parity. You adjust for prices. So you look at China, 30% bigger than us, and it's going to be twice our size within 10 years. I mean, twice the size. And you have an arms race with a country that size? You know, we had an arms race with the Soviet Union. It was very expensive, and that was only about a quarter the size of the United States. So you could say goodbye to the Green New Deal, to Medicare, not only Medicare for all, Medicare, traditional Medicare. You wouldn't be able to afford anything. So, yeah, and that is the direction that our, again, so-called national security state is going right now. But I think there's another way that's even perhaps more pernicious in the way that this permanent war state and permanent war economy works to prevent domestic change. And even people, you know, who don't like Bernie, for example, like Paul Krugman, have written about this. You know, you look at the Iraq War in 2003, it started, but the buildup was in 2002. And that was very deliberately done by the Republicans so that they could win the Congress. And it was successful in that sense. And they knocked all the issues out of the news except the war, or the impending war, as they moved, you know, weapons and troops to the Middle East and prepared for the war. And from August to November, and they pretty much, you know, Cheney pretty much admitted that. And that was the rollout. That was what they did. And I think you have a very big threat of that, of Trump going to war in October, because, you know, I think, if you look at it, we can talk about this more if you want, but, you know, he had this confrontation with Iran, not to have a war in the last month or so, which wouldn't do him any good, but to prepare the ground so that he can have a war which the media will support in October. And you can see this in the New York Times reporting, for example. You know, David Sanger, who covers this stuff in detail and is their main foreign policy reporter, he said after the killing of the Iranian general, he said, well, you know, we're back to where we were in 2015 before the Iran nuclear agreement, where Iran is two or three months away from a nuclear weapon. And what was, what were United States and Israel thinking then in 2015? The only way they were going to prevent a nuclear weapon in Iran was to bomb their facility. And he presents this as though this is now the alternative. And so now Trump has what he needs. And you look at his behavior in that whole crisis. He wasn't looking for the war right now. He wanted to get to the point where he can bomb Iran at the time that it'll help him win re-election. And I think it's his main chance for re-election, you know, because George W. Bush got 15 points increased approval rating when he started the war in Iraq in March of 2003. So that is the way, that is another way in which the this wouldn't necessarily be even a full-blown war. It could be just bombing the so-called nuclear facility. I mean, it has high, very high risk of developing into a terrible war, worse than the Iraq war. But he wouldn't care, because if he does it at just the right time, he's going to get reelected in the way it's set up right now.
You know, I'm really pleased you mentioned this potential of a October surprise, quote unquote, because this is something within Code Pink we've been talking about as well with our own Medea Benjamin, who you know and who has a lot of experience in and out of Iran. And this is our organizational fear as well, that that all of this is a lead up to some major pre-election event in October.
Well, he's preparing the ground for it, definitely, because these things work. You know, how did Bush get his 15 points from the Iraq war? And it didn't do him any good, actually, because it, you know, it went away in about a month or so. But how did he get that? He got it because the media really supported the war. And that's what happens. The media supports the war right away. And then the opposition party politicians generally support it, at least temporarily, and then you have this this really almost foolproof strategy if the president times it correctly.
Well, and it sounds like he certainly got the clock, so he can certainly time it as well as he wants to do it. You know, I'm curious that, you know, as I'm listening to you, the two of you have this piece of conversation and reflecting on some of the meanings of this and how we got to this. I have to confess, I watched the Super Bowl last weekend, and one of the things I was struck by yet again was the adulation of the military, and how from the Super Bowl to the community band concert, we hear again and again and again how wonderful the military is and all this military music. And I wonder how we work both for this coming October, but also for a longer term, to educate people to the contrary. And I'm curious. I'd like to hear your thoughts, Mark, but also yours, Yanni, about the influence of the military on you as a student.
So, me as a student and being black, the military has, like, okay, so I'm a criminology major, and so I guess I was talking, I believe, with Aria, one of our other Code Pink employees the other day, and basically just talking about, like, the correlation of, like, the military and its effect on black people, and how I've noticed that, like back home, like, I have, like, a few friends who have felt like because, like, they couldn't get off the streets or because they couldn't pursue an education that they wanted to, that the military was the only option. It was, like, opting out of, so it was like being in a situation where you were surviving at a means of not the most legal. And so in order to get yourself out, you had to put yourself in these drastic, traumatic experiences, being the military, in order to get out. And then just talking about how it has contributed to destroying people personally. So it's like you try to find a means of survival only to put yourself in a different environment, only to be destroyed as an individual when you come out. And so it's kind of a sad cycle that I see. And like, even like, for example, like I've related it to like my criminology studies of like a lot of people who they're on the streets, they're trying to survive, they end up in jail. And that is a hard time to survive when people come out of that, only because they sometimes they aren't bad people. They just do things because they need to put food on their table. They need to figure out a ways in which they need to get by. The neighborhoods they live in are terrible. And so then they go through the jail process and then they come out not who they were when they went in. It's like different ways in which trying to survive, and especially in communities like my own, personally being Black, have led us to find means where it's like we're trapped in this everlasting cycle of it's like be destroyed or be destroyed. And it's like, which way do you go? And the military seems just more like a societal acceptance. It seems easier to be accepted. It's like, okay, well, I'd rather go to the military than be in jail. But when you think about it, the outcome is the same and you're still stuck. So like when you're in the system, it's like you're deemed to be trapped in like forever, no matter what. It's like you're going to keep committing the same crimes because when you get out, there's no help. When you're in the military, you're there and they support you while you're there. But when you're done, they throw you out as if you never did the service you did. And then you're trapped. You're homeless. You have no food. You have PTSD. You're struggling. Your family doesn't recognize you. And then it's just like all these terrible things that you have to deal with. So it coincides with one another.
Wow, I think we've got a whole program there for the future. So you're just saying both options destroy the humanity of a person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And we're looking at what, you know, Pocky, when you and I were younger, there was an actual draft. But what you're describing, Yanni, is basically an economic and demographic draft imposed on people.
Yeah.
Even though there's no conscription, so to speak.
So, Mark, what's the answer?
Well, in terms of the education, I agree with everything that was just said. And, you know, the hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops actually have come back besides the, you know, more than 4,500 that were killed in the Iraq War and the tens of thousands wounded. They come back with PTSD and with traumatic brain injury. And so they have real struggles here because of that as well. And there, and so, you know, this is these are the huge costs of war. This is one of the reasons why the total cost of the Iraq War was something like $6 trillion. You got these healthcare costs; people need attention for the rest of their lives in many cases.
And look, we're still paying for the Vietnam War. My ex-husband is a Vietnam vet who is receiving treatment from the VA at this point, and he's ended up miraculously, and I give him a lot of credit for the success he's had coming back home. But there are still medical costs associated with his service in 1968. And we don't talk about that, you know, just because the troops come home doesn't mean we stop our war spending.
Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, in terms of the education you asked about, you know, how do we educate people? Obviously, you know, Code Pink and the anti-war movement is doing a lot. And the Yemen vote was a great example. I mean, that was a result of just massive public education. The media didn't report that. That took like 5 years.
Yes.
The media didn't even report on that war until the military. The Washington Post first reported on it when the military was complaining about the effort in Congress to pull us out of the war. And that became the news story, the generals and the press saying this is wrong and the president should have the right to wage war, which is against the Constitution. But in terms of education, so I think that, you know, obviously the work that you all do and the in terms of actually organizing people around these issues is the most important. But I think the thing is, there's also an opportunity. Elections provide an opportunity to have multi-issue organizing, which we don't usually have, right? Not everybody's going to join an anti-war movement, but they might still care, and especially if it's linked to other issues, and there are alliances built between groups. And that's why I think, you know, this kind of an election especially is so important. I mean, look at Biden, for example. He was, you know, you now have it in the news. You've had it recent weeks and months that he voted for the Iraq War, and that's how the New York Times reports it, and they've had big articles. But, you know, that's missing most of the story. The real story is he was the elected official most responsible for the Iraq War outside of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. That is, he was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 2002. When the Senate voted to authorized to give Bush the authority to invade Iraq. And he led that effort, and he got it through the Senate and through Congress. And that's an enormous thing that he did, an enormous responsibility for the war. And that poses a real question, you know, regardless of who you were for or against in the primary, you know, what kind of message does it send if the largest political party in the country is to nominate somebody who participated, who was a leader of this effort to launch a war that was based on lies, as we all know now, and that killed, the best estimates say a million people, including thousands of U.S. Soldiers. And how is that, you know, that should be a major issue in the campaign.
So, you know, that just makes me want to say they're all in the same club. And we saw that at the State of the Union address the other night as well, how many Democrats stood up with the president and the Republican Party and recognized this faux coup U.S. coup-installed president of Venezuela.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, I mean, I agree with you completely on that particular point. But I wouldn't lump the parties that close together, because the base of these two parties is vastly different, and some of the leadership. I mean, we have now a number of progressive members of Congress. You have the Progressive Caucus, which has dozens of progressive members of Congress. I mean, the caucus itself is something like over 90, 98 members. They succeeded in getting a majority of both houses to vote to get the U.S. military out of a war. They have had other successes as well. I wouldn't lump it, you know, obviously you do have a foreign policy establishment in this country, which, you know, people I know here refer to as the Blob. You know, that was from Ben Rhodes in the Obama administration called them. And you know, they are all alike. They do think alike on most issues. And Latin America happens to be one of the worst places where they all kind of agree, and the media agrees too, because there you don't have much differences of opinion within the Pentagon, the State Department, the 17 intelligence agencies, the National Security Council. In Latin America, they all have pretty much the same view. I wouldn't even, you know, you don't even have to say pretty much, don't qualify. The same view is, you know, this is our so backyard, as John Kerry said publicly a couple of years ago, you know, and we own it. But you have more differences in the rest of the world, and you're getting more differences on Latin America. You do have a whole number of senators, I mean, as many as 100 at a time that have pushed back on U.S. policy in Central America, in Honduras, for example, and on Brazil now as well, and even on Argentina. So you do have it. It's just, it's a hard battle. The hardest battle, is on foreign policy is Latin America, and it's mostly because the whole Blob, which I would include the vast majority of the media, takes the same position that the U.S. runs this place. And, the whole 21st century of U.S. policy, including both the Obama and Bush administration, was to get back, to get rid of these left governments that were elected and had established more independence than Latin America had for 500 years. And their process, their goal since then has been to reverse that.
So this is a conversation for another radio show, Mark, and I hope that you can come back for another hour with us and discuss U.S. Foreign policy in Latin America. We are about ready to wrap up this week's program of Code Pink Radio, and I'm so, so thankful you were able to give us the full hour today. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and have you share your experience and knowledge with our listeners.
And we'll take on now pushing our reps to look at Latin America again. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you.
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The New Hampshire primary is less than a week away, and the Iowa Democratic Party still hasn't released complete results from Monday night's caucuses following technical issues. The state party released more caucus results last night, with former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg barely holding on to a narrow lead with 26.2% of the delegates, as Senator Bernie Sanders pulled into a near tie with 26.1%. With 97% of precincts reporting, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren was in third, followed by former Vice President Joe Biden and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. It's unclear when the full results from Monday's voting will be finalized. A report from the New York Times published this morning reveals that over 100 precincts reported results that were internally inconsistent, missing data, or were not possible under caucus rules. The report says the inconsistencies don't appear to be intentional, and they don't appear biased towards either Buttigieg or Sanders, the leading candidates. But because the top two candidates are only separated by three state delegate equivalents out of over 2,000 awarded, any irregularities make determining a clear winner all but impossible. Democratic officials have attributed the chaos in Iowa to a newly created app built by a little-known firm called Shadow. To make matters worse, a top state Democrat said supporters of President Trump flooded a hotline used by Iowa precinct chairs to report Democratic caucus results, worsening delays in the statewide tally. The Republican-led Senate yesterday acquitted President Trump on charges that he abused his power and obstructed Congress. The vote on the abuse of power allegation was 48-52, with Utah Senator Mitt Romney as the only Republican to vote to convict Trump. The obstruction vote fell entirely along party lines, 47-53. The White House called the result of the impeachment trial a full vindication. The president shared a video featuring a fake magazine cover with signs showing him staying in power past 2024, far beyond the two terms allowed under the Constitution. Trump also tweeted a video claiming Mitt Romney was a secret Democratic asset. Go figure. The death toll from China's coronavirus outbreak surged again today, rising by 74 to a total of 564 people. It was the third straight record one-day increase. There have been two deaths outside mainland China, one in the Philippines and the other in Hong Kong. A 12th coronavirus case in the United States was confirmed by health officials in Wisconsin yesterday. More than 500 people have been quarantined on U.S. military bases after being evacuated from the Chinese province where the outbreak started. At least one additional government evacuation flight is expected this week. The Justice Department will launch an investigation into several Mississippi prisons after a series of inmate deaths and reports of rampant violence, corruption, and unsanitary conditions. The most noteworthy institution is Parchman Prison, where nine inmates have died in little more than a month. Several deaths have been attributed to violence or suicide. The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division will investigate the state of mental health care at the facility, as well as its use of isolation. More than two dozen inmates recently filed a lawsuit with the help of rapper Jay-Z for an emergency protective order to allow an independent agency to take over the prison's day-to-day operations. And in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Israeli troops shot dead a 17-year-old Palestinian person yesterday during a protest in the city of Hebron against President Trump's Middle East plan. Mohammed al-Haddad is the first Palestinian killed in demonstrations that erupted after Trump unveiled his plan last week. Under the plan, drafted by Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, without any input from Palestinians, Israel would gain sovereignty over large areas of the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem would be totally under Israeli control, and all Jewish settlers colonizing occupied Palestinian territory would be allowed to remain in their homes. Weather in Washington, D.C. today is rainy with highs in the